Okay, so today is Saturday, November 9th, 2013. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we continue with the examination of the Majjhima Nikaya. And today we'll be taking sutta number 110. This is the shorter discourse on the full moon night. The last class we had was on the preceding sutta, the longer or greater discourse on the full moon night. And that sutta dealt with the number of deep, perplexing philosophical questions about the nature of the five aggregates, the nature of clinging, and so forth. And this sutta is comparatively very simple, very basic. And so I was even tempted to skip over this one, thinking that it's something that we've already know, we've already come across already. But I thought it's important to cover material like this, because if one just focuses on the suttas dealing with, the deep issues of doctrine or the practice of advanced stages of meditation, then you get the impression that Buddhism is somewhat, the Buddha's teaching is somewhat disconnected from ordinary life, that it's just concerned with highly abstruse issues and with very advanced practices for renunciants and yogis. But the Buddha's teaching also has quite a wide range. It applies to just about all aspects of our everyday life. And so I think we also have to bear in mind that these teachings also need attention. And especially not only attention, but we also have to see the relevance of these teachings to our everyday life and learn how to apply them in our everyday life. A distinction that I sometimes have made and used as a sort of template for teaching is a distinction between two aspects of the Buddha's teaching. We call this the, using the Pali words, Lokiya and Lokuttara Dhamma. That is the mundane or world application teaching. And the Lokuttara is the supramundane or world transcendent teaching. And then if we want to use a more elaborate scheme, there's a scheme that, I've encountered this in Master Yenshin's The Way to Buddhahood, but I think he derives this from earlier classifications in Chinese Buddhism. So the mundane teaching will be divided into the human vehicle, and the celestial or heavenly vehicle, the These would be the teachings that are applicable to the human realm and that lead to a favorable rebirth within the human realm. And then we have the celestial vehicle, the teachings that are conducive to a rebirth into the heavenly or celestial realms. Then we have the world transcendent teachings. According to the Chinese way of classification, we have the three vehicles of the disciples or shravakas, the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddhas, sometimes called the solitary or non-teaching Buddhas. And then we have the Bodhisattva vehicle. So the teachings that come under the world and the heading of being world transcendent, those are the teachings that are sort of unique and special to the Buddha Dharma, including the teachings on three characteristics, dependent origination, four noble truths, and the practices that bring this world transcendent realization, the four foundations of mindfulness, the seventh, the development of the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. But what's important to realize is that to develop successfully the world transcendent teachings, one has to base them upon a secure foundation of the mundane teachings, which are the basic teachings in generosity, ethics, right attitudes, and even the what's called the mundane right view. So, you know, many people, especially in the West, when they come across Buddhism, they get all excited about the very deep philosophical issues, like the meaning of emptiness, mind only, non-self dependent origination. They want to practice intensive insight meditation, quickly get enlightenment. But when you come to the very basic mundane teachings, they think boring, uninteresting, not essential. But the Buddha's teaching, we have to see, is something like constructing a building. You know, if you don't have a secure foundation, you want to have some beautiful rooms on the second floor, maybe with a ornamental roof, you know, with these sloping, maybe you've designed the roof in Tang Dynasty style, with curves, very beautifully designed. Then you have a pinnacle on the top, but you don't have a solid foundation. What's going to happen to the house? What will happen? The house will start after 6 months, a year. The house is going to start to collapse, right? Or it's starting to decay and break down, and then it collapses. So if we want to build a solid, secure house, have to start with very basic practices and really make a strong commitment and dedication to these practices. And then one could build up the house story by story. And when you have a solid foundation, when the ground floor is solid with strong timber, steady, solid walls, well-designed scaffolding of the house, then you can build the second floor and put in your fancy rooms and build a very decorative roof and put a nice pinnacle on top of the roof. And so for this reason, when the Buddha teaches, when we come across the Buddha, sort of the outline of the Buddha's teaching that we encounter often in the suttas, we see that the Buddha teaches what's called anupubhika katha, anupubhakata. That is a graduated teaching, a step-by-step teaching. So the Buddha, when he's speaking to a new audience, he'll begin with the practices of dana, generosity, the practice of sila, of virtue, covering these quite extensively. Then he'll bring in the teachings on the heavenly realms, explaining how the practices of generosity and virtuous conduct can lead to rebirth in the heavenly realms. Then gradually he'll introduce the teaching on what's the text called, the danger, the unsatisfactoriness in sensual pleasures, the benefits of renunciation. And then when the Buddha sees that the minds of the people who he's speaking to have become settled, calm, confident, trusting, clear of obstructions, clear of hindrances, then he introduces the teaching that's special to the Buddha, that is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Okay, and so in the sutta that is given, that we'll be looking at today, these are the teachings which you might say constitute the timber, the 2x4s, the planks that are going to form the foundation of the house of Dharma practice. These are very basic teachings. It seems it's a bit, even a bit intriguing that the Buddha gives this discourse not to householders, but he's giving it to the community of monks on a full moon night. Usually on the full moon night, the Buddha speaks on profound subjects. But here he's speaking on these very basic practices. Okay, so let us take a look at the sutta. Okay, so here the sutta unfolds when the Buddha is living at Savatthi in the eastern part, in the palace of Vigara's mother. And so this is the Uposatha day, this is the day of the special observance, the 15th day of the fortnight, and it's the full moon night. And so the Buddha is sitting out in the open, surrounded by the community of monks. And then after all of the monks are sitting there silently in meditation, then they're expecting the Buddha at a certain point to begin to speak to them. So when the Buddha feels that the time is ready, then he begins to speak. And he begins with introducing the topic of this discourse, which will be the contrast between what is here called, and I don't like this terminology, but it was what Venerable Nyanamoli used in the original draft of this translation. It's the contrast between what is here called an untrue man and a true man. We have to remember that Venerable Nyanamoli was translating back in the early 1950s when the word man still stood for any human being. So now if I were to revise this, I would use, instead of man, I would use person. And I don't even like untrue and true. I think that's a little bit misleading or inaccurate or even unclear. Let's take the Pali words that are used here. At first, the word that is rendered man is purisa, which sometimes the word purisa is used in contrast to iti. In that case, it means a man in contrast to a woman. But purisa can also function as a general word for just for any human being. So it can be a man or a woman. So we would say the purisa is person. And then it's prefixed. Well, the primary prefix here would be the word sat, which can mean both true and also good. So, for example, in the word satya, we have the Four Noble Truths. These are the four chatari, arya, satchani, satya. There we have truth. And so on that basis, we can say that sat has the implication of what is true. But the word sat also has the meaning of good. And in some contexts, good is preferable to true. So I think here we can say that the contrast, the asapurisa, is the person who is not good, or we could say the bad person, and sampurisa is the person who is good, the good person.
Yeah, I just wanted to know that the translation I have is person with no integrity, person of integrity. And I have this little afterward.
Yeah, that is maybe a little more elaborate than is necessary. But I mean, it's on the mark, we could say. But to keep it very simple, we could just say a good person and a bad person. And what is significant in the use of this term, especially the term sapurisa, is that this seems to be a kind of ideal that the Buddha was setting up for people in the society of the period in which he lived. In the period in which the Buddha was living, in the mainstream society, because it was divided into the four social classes, which came to be later called the castes and formed the basis for the caste system. So we have the distinction here between the Brahmin, who is the priest, the specialist in the religious lore of the Vedas, the one who's entitled to perform the religious ceremonies, especially for the royalty, but even for everybody in their day-to-day life. Then we have the kshatriyas or khatiyas, the administrative class, the rulers, the administrators, the warriors. Then we have the Vaishyas, who would be the mercantile caste, the class of people involved in business, trade, also the people who owned large plots of land for cultivation of crops and cattle. And then we have the Sudras, the menial class, the working class, the lower class. And then beyond them, outside of them, we have those who are outside the class system. And so within the framework of the class system, it was believed, or at least the Brahmins propagated the idea that in order to be a useful member of society, a person has to fulfill the duties that are incumbent upon them by reason of their position within the class system. So the Brahmin should fulfill his functions. The kshatriyas should rule and administer the land. The vaishyas should fulfill their responsibilities of trade, business, finance, cultivation. And the shudras should just work for the others and serve the others. But the Buddha replaced, or at least he was attempting to replace, this rigid class system with a different social system in which what was of primary significance was not a person's birth, not their social class status, but their inner qualities. And to promote this vision or this social ideal, the Buddha developed this concept of the Sampurisa, the good person, who is not restricted to any particular social class, but serves as an ideal which members of any social class should strive to fulfill. And so even though the Buddha didn't explicitly reject the class system, but in his own teaching it seems that he would still speak about the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, but he would collapse the members of all the other social classes into the broad category of householders, Gahapati. And then even putting the social class distinction sort of on the margins, the Buddha held up for all of his followers the ideal of the Sampurisa. And so for whatever one's class position within the mainstream society, one's worth as a person, one's worth as an individual is determined by the degree to which one measures up to the standard of the Sampurisa. And so the Sampurisa is not necessarily a noble one, not necessarily one who has reached the stages of noble realization, transcendent realization, because that probably would have been confined to a relatively small number of people in the Buddhist community. Of course, the Buddha set up the ideal standard as being the attainment of the four stages of realization. But for the great majority of disciples, the Buddha laid down guidelines which would direct them towards the ideal of the Sampurisa, the good person, the person who is able to live effectively for his own benefit of others, the benefit of society as a whole. And so in this sutta, we could say that, or see that the Buddha is positing this contrast between people distinguished as either good or bad, not on the basis of their class position, not on the basis of whether they're fulfilling their social class obligations according to the rigid class system, but on the basis of certain other criteria that the Buddha is laying out, criteria which distinguishes one as either asapurisa, a non-good or a bad person, or sampurisa, a good person. And so let's see now how this theme is developed in the sutta. And it begins with a statement I find a little bit curious. I'll use my revised translation rather than the original translation here. So the Buddha is saying, monks, would a bad person know of a bad person? This person is a bad person. And then the monks say, no, Venerable Sir. And then the Buddha says, good. It's impossible, it cannot be, that a bad person would know of a bad person. This one is a bad person. Then he says, would an bad person know of a good person? This one is a good person. And the monks say no. And then the Buddha says, good, it's impossible, it cannot be that a bad person would know of a good person. This person is a good person. I have to say, I find this puzzling, because there's a statement I think I've heard, you know, circulating in America that when a thief meets another thief, he knows right away that that one is a thief. And I know, you know, back in the days when I was a bad, mischievous student in class, when we had started a new class, come into the classroom and you look around, and being a mischievous little student, I could look around and I could see which ones are going to be my companions amongst the troublemakers and which ones are going to be the ones we would call the brown noses. Do you know, do they still use that expression? Or maybe the Chinese students don't, the Chinese ones here don't know that expression. This is the one who tries to ingratiate himself to the teacher, or does the, you know, brushes off the teacher's seat at the beginning of the class, gives the teacher the apple, brings an apple for the teacher at the class. You know, so I come into the class and I could look at my pals, the guys who are going to be my pals, and the students that we're going to beat up after class. Somebody, you're a psychologist, so you should be able to.
Well, I was just wondering if what you're saying was that a bad person really doesn't know the difference between right and wrong.
Okay, say that again into the microphone.
Is this working? I was wondering if what he was saying was that a bad person is a person who does not know the difference between right and wrong.
It doesn't seem that he's saying that here, because if that was the intention, he would have a very he would express that in a different way. He would say, does a bad person know what is unwholesome and what is wholesome, or what is bad or what is good? So it's puzzling to me, this statement. Does anybody have any ideas about this? Is it Katie in the back? Please take the microphone.
Maybe it's similar to what both are saying. One is enjoying one's fellow company. And not really saying, I'm bad, he's bad, I'm just saying, there's my kind.
Or maybe, actually, what you said just gave an idea, planted an idea in my mind. Maybe the sense is that maybe also this will tie in what David suggested, that the bad person, he'll know who the bad person is. He'll know that this is the one that either he's going to team up with, or the one that he's going to treat as a rival if they're both in a competition for some position. But he won't recognize the fact that what they're doing is bad. And he won't feel some kind of repugnance towards the bad qualities of the other bad person. And also he won't recognize that the good person is a person that he should be emulating. And he won't appreciate the good qualities of the good person. So maybe that's a solution to the problem here. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to now enumerate a number of features that distinguish the bad person as being bad. It actually turns out that there are 8 criteria here for this distinguishing the bad person. So he's possessed of bad qualities. Then the second is that he associates with other bad persons. The third is that here it's translated, he wills, or we could even say he thinks as a bad person. Then he gives counsel or advice in the way that a bad person does. Then he speaks as a bad person. He acts as a bad person. He holds the views of a bad person, and when he gives gifts, he gives them in the manner of a bad person. Okay, so now the Buddha first, he sets up this kind of summary or outline of the teaching, and now he's going to elaborate on each of these criteria of the bad person. So first he raises the question, how is the bad person possessed of bad qualities? And then he's going to, he mentions here seven qualities, which I prefer to take them actually as the qualities, the opposites, the qualities of the good person. So we could jump over to the next page, page 894, and page 16. Because here we have a list of seven qualities that we meet, not often, but we meet occasionally throughout the texts. I think we meet them especially several times in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Book of the Sevens, but elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya. So these seven qualities that are mentioned form a set, which are called the good, simply the good qualities, or the qualities of the good person. And so here it said that the good person has faith, shame, fear of wrongdoing, he's learned, energetic, mindful, and wise. So these qualities are laid out in a way which forms a kind of sequence. And so at the foundation of the seven good qualities, we have faith. And here, I don't think that faith is intended necessarily in the sense of faith as necessarily in the sense of accepting all of the Buddha's teachings. But what I understand by this term is a basic faith in, I would say, in the fact that there is a law of goodness, a universal law sort of operating behind the scenes, which will support a good person and their endeavors to fulfill goodness, a law which will bring happiness, fulfillment, spiritual development to a person who devotes himself or herself to the good. And so having faith in this sense is not restricted, I would say it's not restricted or confined to specific Buddhist faith, but I would say like a person of any religious conviction or even of no religious conviction at all who still believes that there is value, benefit in doing what is virtuous and wholesome will have this kind of faith. And this would be contrasted to the attitude of the bad person who would take the position that there's no point in doing good, no point in avoiding evil, that there are no consequences of one's actions, that one could behave in any way oneself, that any way one could behave in any way one wishes, and especially who thinks that they could behave in bad, evil ways and get away with it when nobody knows what they're doing. Okay, on the basis of faith, a kind of trust in the power of goodness, then one has, or there emerges two other qualities which are always paired in the suttas, which work together as a team. These are the qualities which are called in Pali, hiri and otapa. So faith is sadha, faith or trust. that based on this faith and trust, there arise these two qualities, hiri and otapa, which the Buddha calls these two qualities the guardians of the world, lokapala, the two qualities that protect the world. And these are the two qualities which are the basis, well, you could say even the roots of ethical behavior, the roots of moral behavior. What is called hiri, when we translate it as shame, it's a little a sense of shame, it's a little misleading, because the sense of shame is something that usually arises when we've committed something bad or unwholesome. Then afterwards we feel some embarrassment about it. And that's the ordinary significance of the English word shame. But hiri is a quality that operates, it has a kind of anticipating role. It's the quality that prevents one from doing something unwholesome, something unethical, from the realization that by behaving in this way, one will be losing one's self-respect. One will be detracting from one's own inner dignity, that one will be creating a blemish on one's own character, or that one will be blocking the full flowering of one's potential nobility of character. And so hiri is an inward voice that tells one, if one behaves in such a way, if one engages in such behavior, one will not be able to live comfortably with oneself. One will be soiling the potential purity of one's mind. One will be creating inner obstacles to one's spiritual development. Now, this quality of hiri is paired with this other quality called otapa, which comes from a root. The root of the word otapa is the middle three letters tap, which means to burn. And so tapa, otapa, means, here it's translated, fear of wrongdoing. We might also translate it as moral dread. And this is the quality, the inner voice that prevents one from doing wrong, what's unwholesome, what's ethically bad, from fear of the consequences, from a fear that, for example, if other people find out what one has done, then one is going to be blamed and criticized by others, rejected by others. One becomes a social pariah, a social outcast. Or it can take the form of fear of the consequences, fear that if it's something that's really bad or unwholesome, illegal, that one will be caught by the law and be arrested and have to serve time in prison. And then also, this fear of consequences is coupled with an understanding of the law of karma. So one realizes that if one does something unwholesome, even if one can get away with it in the face of society, so if one thinks one is clever enough that one could conceal one's wrongdoing so nobody will discover and punish one in this world, one still has to face the consequences of the maturation of one's karma. That the karma, the unwholesome karma created by that immoral, unethical action is going to catch up with one and bring an unhappy rebirth, bring misery and suffering in the future. And so in some of the commentaries, the distinction between hiri and otapa, the sense of shame and moral dread, is illustrated with the simile of a piece of timber or a log which, let's see, yeah, at both ends it's burning, it's blazing with flame, and in the middle it's soiled with feces. And so the person doesn't want to touch the log in the middle, because if he does, picks it up in the middle, he'll get soiled by the feces. And he doesn't want to pick it up on either end, because if he tries to do that, his hand will get burnt. And so getting soiled with the feces, that is illustrated by which of these two qualities? Right, hiri, the sense of shame, and then not wanting to pick up the log because from fear that one will be burnt by touching the flame. That is like otapa, fear of the consequences, or moral dread. Okay, David?
This is like, you're talking about developing a sense of morality.
Exactly.
That's what this is.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's why I said that these are the two sort of underlying roots of sila, of moral behavior.
It's like a superego.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Not very close. Katie? I said fear of wrongdoing, moral dread, and you said conscientiousness?
At the Abhidhamma retreat, I think you also offered for otapa conscientiousness with and or moral dread. Is that still something you think is part of that conscientiousness, or is that the fruit of these two?
I'd say conscientiousness. Yeah, it could be taken as close to hiri. You were saying that I explained it as moral dread?
I think during the Abhidhamma, you were proposing, someone can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but that hiri would be shame, but that was cautious about the spirit of that word, or the emotion. But I thought otapa, moral dread, was also translated as conscientiousness, but you preferred moral dread.
I think conscientious, if somebody's being conscientious, it seems to me that they're more that they're heeding the inner voice of conscience rather than fear of the consequences.
So more hearing.
Yeah, I was going to say conscientiousness is closer to hearing. But maybe it embraces both of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue now. Okay, so we have faith, shame, fear of wrongdoing. The next one is learning, which here, of course, would refer to the learning of religious texts, this, what we call the sacred scriptures. It's not like learning, being very learned in French literature of the 17th century. Or French literature of the 19th century, which might have a corrupting influence on some of these models. A learning in the physical sciences. But this is, in the Buddha's time, the word here is actually sutta, which means hearing, having heard a lot, because when one attends religious expositions of religious teachings, the way one acquires learning is to attend expositions or discourses on religious teachings. Rather than, in the Buddha's time, there were not printed books. Okay, and so learning is considered an important good quality. And then that comes, now we have the three qualities which are actually moving towards transcendent realization. This is energy, which is always explained as the effort to remove what is unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome. Then being mindful, in the sense of having a basic awareness. Probably here, maybe we could say mindfulness is intended more in a moral sense than in the meditative sense. So being mindful, say, of one's states of mind, one's motivations, being mindful of what one is doing so that one can restrain oneself from doing what is bad. And then having wisdom, which at the most basic level is the wisdom to be able to distinguish what is unwholesome, what is wholesome, and to be able to distinguish, to know, to understand what are the underlying motivations of unwholesome behavior and the basic motivations of wholesome behavior. So, for example, it would include the understanding of the three unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion, the three wholesome roots of generosity, kindness, wisdom, understanding what are the 10 ways of unwholesome karma, the 10 ways of wholesome karma. So it's from that fundamental, practical, ethical wisdom that the higher wisdom will emerge and develop. But in order for that higher wisdom to unfold successfully, it has to be grounded upon this fundamental, practical, ethical wisdom. Okay, so in this way we have these 7 good qualities that are represented by the good person, and those are contrasted with the 7 bad qualities which are possessed by the bad person. So, any questions on this point about any of these qualities? Okay, David? I'm sorry, Richard?
Yeah, I'm puzzled by the relationship between paragraph 15 and 16. That is, they're both are designated, they're 2 sets of 7 good qualities, but I'm not sure whether 16 is redefining or giving parallel terms for 15, which doesn't seem to be the case, because in 17 through 23, when they're described one by one, that relationship isn't borne out. That is, it's not parallel. Instead, there are sort of selections from 16 that are applied to the elements of 15.
Well, 15 is the counterpart to number 4. So 15 is laying out the outline, or we could almost call this the table of contents.
Yeah, 17 to 23, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But then exactly what is 16? Why are those 7 terms, also called good qualities, selected when their application in 17 to 18 seems erratic or arbitrary in some way? It's where the systematic part is in 15. Just what is the list of 16? What is the connection between 16 and, for that matter, both either 15 or 17 to 23?
Okay, as I said, 15 is laying out a kind of table of contents or an outline of, there are 8 factors that are mentioned here. Now, one of these factors, the first one, is possessing the 7 good dhammas. Now, some of those good dhammas are going to enter into the exposition of the later criteria of the good person. But the 7 good dhammas is a separate set within itself.
Yeah.
And the criteria that determine the good man following the good qualities will be ways in which the good person, the true man, embodies goodness in the way he associates, the way he wills, counsels, and so forth. We'll see this because I'm going to continue now with the exposition. So maybe it will become clear as we go along. Okay, so let's go now from the true man or good man possessed of good qualities. Then we have, how does the good person associate as a good person? In other words, what kind of person does a good person associate with? And so here the Buddha says, here the good person has for his friends and companions those ascetics and Brahmins who have faith, shame, fear of wrongdoing, who are learned, energetic, mindful, and wise. So here we have the seven good qualities, but here they enter into a different role. So now they're not the qualities that the good person has within himself, but the good person, when he wants to associate with ascetics and Brahmins, perhaps this would be like the lay person, what kind of qualities is he going to look for in a spiritual teacher? Is he going to look for the teacher who drives around in a Mercedes-Benz or a Rolls-Royce and has lots of, you know, dazed eyes, disciples looking at him and saying, you know, sadhu, 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 and then he's charging, you know, $1,000 to attend one of his retreats and living on a beautiful island that they've bought and surrounding himself with beautiful young women and then keeping flasks of Johnny Walker black whiskey. Is there such a thing? Or is it going to be a person who has these qualities? So the good person, when he associates, he's going to associate with the person who has the good qualities. So he'll look at the various spiritual teachers and then try to find the spiritual teachers who have these good qualities. And I think the Buddha mentions this here because in many other suttas, the Buddha emphasizes the importance of establishing right association. So we have even at the beginning of the Mangala Sutta, Sevanacha Pahalanam Panditanacha Sevana Pujacha Pujaniyanam Gaitang Mangala Muttamam. So one avoids associating with foolish people, one associates with the wise, one honors those who are worthy of honor. And then we have the famous teaching of the Buddha where Ananda comes to the Buddha and says, so far as I understand, the spiritual life, one half of the spiritual life is noble friendship. Then the Buddha says, don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. It's not one half of the spiritual life, but the entirety of the spiritual life depends on noble friendship. And what is the reason for that? It's through noble friendship that one learns to develop, in that sutta, right, all of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, up to right concentration. So if you're going to get good guidance, reliable guidance, you have to associate with those who embody and represent good qualities in themselves. And so that will serve to reinforce one's own good qualities and help one to bring one's own good qualities, to develop them and bring them up to the peak of perfection. Or at least to, if not to the peak of perfection, at least to make them stronger than they are at present. Okay, so next we come to, from associating as a good person, then we come to willing, or it can be thinking as a good person. The word here is sapurisa chinti. So the word chinti has both the two nuances, the nuance of the way one thinks and the way one wills or forms volition. So the text says, Here, a good person does not will for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. And this is contrasted with that of the bad person. In paragraph 7, at the bottom of 892, the bad person wills for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, for the affliction of both. And it might be taken as a point for discussion. Okay, it says here that the good person does not will for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. But why couldn't the text express itself more positively? Why not say that the good person wills for his own welfare, the welfare of others, or the welfare of both? Any thoughts about this? It could be expressed just as easily, just as economically. What is your name?
Phil.
Phil, okay.
Perhaps because...
If you put them... Did you get the microphone?
But perhaps because the sense of self at this point is not willing. It's more harmlessness. There's not a sense of ego willing. It's more of not doing. Of not doing.
Okay, that's possible. Anybody else have any ideas? Okay, Bowie has some idea, please.
Because many, more often than that, many afflictions are caused, are done in the name of benefiting others.
Oh, that's a very good suggestion, yeah. Often people think that they're benefiting others and then they're just imposing their own ideas on others about what should be done for the good of others. Maybe we take like the paradigm of this would be, say, the Soviet Union under Stalin. You know, we're going to have the 5-year economic plan, and so we eliminate all of the private farms, and we have the communal farms. Then we have to get rid of certain population groups which are bad for the development of the country. And then we have the development of China under Mao Zedong. They all think that they're doing good, but they're doing what is harmful. Any other ideas? Okay, Jim?
The wealthy may cause the people to attach to it and grasp on it. But affection is kind of to reject it eventually.
Okay, that's possible too. I don't have like one definite answer in mind. I'm not like testing you to find out, you know, are they going to get it right? Right or wrong? Just to see what ideas. Please. You can stand up. So.
It might mean something if you find a bigger set. You know, like in mathematics, you know, you have true and not true. So yeah. Not true is also a bigger set that just simply says false.
Oh, that's actually a very interesting point. Yeah.
So like Pachika Buddha, who attained enlightenment for himself, so not necessarily, you know, helping others.
Okay. We'll take Richard's and I will give my idea, which has to be the right one.
I wonder, what's the relationship between will and mental formations? You know, is he treating will this way because in other contexts he uses will as something essentially negative?
No, I don't think the Buddha ever uses will itself as essentially negative.
Okay. Well, what are the word what's the word for will, and what's the word for mental formation?
Okay, here in this passage, the word that's used is chinti. Where's my... So here the word is chinti. It's being used as a suffix. Sapurisa chinti. And now there's a root, a verbal root, chit, from which we get many other words. We get chitta, which is a state of mind. We get chaitana. Chaitana is the word that normally means volition. Then from chit we also get chinta, which means something like a thought in the sense of a reflection. And these are all different. The word that's translated as mental formations, the fourth aggregate is, of course, sankhara. But when the Buddha explains the aggregate of mental formations or sankhara, he usually does it in terms of chaitanya, volition. So that's why I've been translating sankhara khanda as the aggregate of volitional formations or volitional activities. Okay, we'll take Katie.
I just wanted to ask if you at one point would speak to this point here, which is basically the cataphatic and the apophatic argument. Wait, I know, and this is practical, sir, nothing, because there's a sutta in Maitipacibhota where the Buddha speaks specifically about the teacher. He's aware of the trap that the teacher who speaks in this is not non-happiness, this is not non-self, the sort of a broad set that would include more through what something is not non. And yeah. I think that is, at some point, a person will come to that way of thinking in this study. I think it has real practical benefits, so I'm asking you to consider that at some point too.
Okay, I think, well, I think my understanding corresponds to, what is your name again?
Hong.
To what he said, though, without using a mathematical terminology. But I think the basic reason is that, first of all, the Buddha sometimes has to function on restraining, or at least in his teaching, he has to enjoin restraining and preventing what's unwholesome in order to sort of clear the field for the wholesome. And so, if a person is habituated to willing or to forming purposes that it will be harmful to himself, harmful to others, harmful to both, sort of the first step in developing a good attitude is to restrain those volitions which are harmful to oneself, harmful to others, harmful to both. Then once one is able to recognize one's volitions and to restrain the unwholesome, then one can develop the wholesome. Another explanation as possible is simply that often an Indian way of style of expression is to use negative terms for ideas that actually in practice have a positive content. For example, when we speak about the three wholesome roots, Kusala Mula, what are they but Aloba, Adosa, Amoha, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. But, well, in a sense, non-greed has quite a broad range, so it can include qualities ranging from generosity through service to others to renunciation, being able to give up the objects of attachment. And non-hatred, non-aversion, like a positive manifestation of it is loving-kindness, but a person who has non-aversion doesn't necessarily go around all the time, you know, may you be well and happy, may you be well and happy, but the important task is to control anger, resentment, hatred. But always when they explain what is meant by non-delusion, the text always equated with panya, with wisdom. Anyway, we do find texts which speak about that a good person wills for sukha-hita, the welfare and happiness of himself, the welfare and happiness of others, the welfare and happiness of both. So there are, you know, both kinds of texts. But I think at the outset, the fundamental task is to begin one's training by restraining the impulses to harm others, to do things that are harmful to oneself, to do things that are harmful to both. Okay, let's continue. Okay, this is a rather unusual passage here, that we have the good, how does the good man or good person counsel as a good person? And here, the good person does not counsel or give advice to others for his own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both. That is how a good person counsels as a good person. Trying to see how this works in actual practice. Somebody comes to me for advice and says, you know, I'm having some trouble with my wife, I don't want to get into marital issues, I'm having some trouble with my children, I want them to go, I want my son to be a doctor, but he wants to study political science or philosophy. So what should I do? What can I do to get him to go on and study medicine? So I have to give him some advice. How do I go about doing this? A way that won't lead to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, or the affliction of both. The mother, or the, usually it's the mother, especially in Jewish families. I want my son to be a doctor. You know, I won't be able to live with myself if he doesn't become a doctor. And he wants to study philosophy. What can he do with it? How do I advise him? Do we have any philosophy majors here? I see at least two of them.
Also yourself,
Andre. Three of them. I don't have a mirror. Three of us, yeah. Again, why not advise for the benefit of oneself, for the benefit of others, for the benefit of both? Anyway, let's move on so we could finish the sutta today. But this is rather unusual, because I don't know of many suttas where the Buddha teaches disciples how they should give advice to others. And here we come to how does one speak as a good person. And this is the basic training in right speech that we find in the Noble Eightfold Path as well as in the 10 courses of wholesome action. So the good person abstains from false speech, from malicious speech, or this is actually divisive speech, speech that creates divisions between people, from harsh speech, and from gossip or idle chatter. And this brings up the interesting point that here we have advice on speech formulated, when it's formulated as a set of rules like this, it's formulated negatively, abstaining from this, abstaining from that. But there are corresponding passages where the Buddha elaborates on these, and then we see in the elaboration that he explains them in positive terms. For example, in Sutta number 27, this would be like page 273. So he's describing the training of a monastic disciple. He says, abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, no deceiver of the world. And then abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. Then it continues, thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, one who speaks words that promote concord. Then the third one, abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech, he speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, words that go to the heart, courteous, desired and agreeable to many. Then abandoning gossip, he speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on Dhamma and discipline, speaks words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So when we have negative formulations, we should understand that they have to be taken together with the positive counterparts. Okay, and similarly with how does the true or good person act as a good person? So here the reference is to bodily action. And so the good person abstains from killing living beings, taking what is not given, and from misconduct and sensual pleasures. And then also if you go back and look at page 272, then you get the positive counterparts to these. So not only does the person in training abstain from killing living beings, but he lives conscientious and merciful, compassionate to all living beings. And so he abstains from taking what is not given. In this case, he abides in purity, or actually I think honesty would be the better rendering here. And here, because the Buddha is speaking with reference to the monk in training, he says, abandoning in celibacy, he observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from sexual intercourse. Okay, so this takes care of, we say that this is the component of right speech and right bodily action. And now we have the basic or fundamental right view. So how does the true man or the good person hold views as a good person, or the views of a good person? And here the good person holds such a view as this. Okay, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. Again, this requires some explanation. So, because it's just an objective fact that if something is given, it's given. But the underlying understanding here is that one practices giving, charity, generosity. One is in some way creating some merits which are going to come back and bring some personal benefit. That there's some kind of moral value in the act of giving, which is connected with the law of karma. And so this is naturally followed by that there is fruit and result of good and bad actions, that there is this world and the other world. Of course, no one can deny that there is this world, but the point here is that part of right view is accepting that there are other realms of existence beyond this realm in which we're living. And from the perspective of beings in the other realms of existence, this realm exists as a possibility of rebirth. That there is mother and father. Of course, nobody is going to be denying that there are mothers and fathers, but the point here is that what's being affirmed is that there is an obligation to serve one's mother and father, or that one has a responsibility to look after one's mother and father, that there are certain objective duties which are incumbent upon one in looking after, taking care of one's mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. I mean, this is one of the modes of rebirth, according to the Buddhist teachings, that there are different ways in which beings are reborn, and in certain planes of existence, beings come into existence spontaneously, without parents, but they just arise, I guess, through the projective force of karma. When they pass away, say, from the human realm, if they're destined to be reborn in the heavenly realms, then just through the force of the karma, they just arise or spring up into existence, rather than through the sexual union of parents. And I think in the lower realms, the hell realms, beings reborn are reborn spontaneously there. So I wonder if somebody is skeptical of the existence of beings who are spontaneously reborn, does that mean they have a wrong view? Okay, and then there is the part of right view is the belief that there are good and virtuous ascetics and Brahmins in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge the nature of this world and the world beyond, and declare them to others. And so probably this aspect of right view involves accepting that when virtuous ascetics and Brahmins declare that they've understood at a deep level the nature of this world and the existence of worlds beyond this present one, and speak about, for example, the way of existence in those worlds, the courses of conduct that lead to those, to existence in those worlds, then one has some kind of trust in them. So all of these are considered aspects of right view. And this is spoken of sometimes as in the text as the mundane right view, which is the forerunner or precondition for the supermundane, world-transcending right view. And to see sort of the significance of this right view in the Buddhist path, one could contrast it with what's taken to be the wrong view, the mundane wrong view. And this is found on the previous page, 893, paragraph 11. So that the bad person holds the view that there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. So the bad person is saying that there's no point in giving, no point in making offerings, no point in charity. You know, when you die, that's the end, everything comes, is finished at death. They take the body to the cremation ground, burn it, and all that remains are ashes. Whether you are a generous person or a miser, a so-called fool or a wise person, at death everybody is just wiped out and eliminated. So no point in doing anything good like practicing generosity. So then there's no fruit or result of good or bad deeds, no worlds beyond the present one, no life beyond the present one into which one can be reborn. No use looking after your mother and father, let them look after themselves. No beings who are reborn spontaneously. And those so-called good and virtuous ascetics and Brahmins in the world who are speaking about the nature of the world and the world beyond, they're just hucksters out to make an easy living. What they're saying, a lot of humbug. You know, don't believe it. You know, why don't they go out and get a decent job instead of just sitting comfortably in their monasteries and their temples? You know, they get a good, solid meal every day. People come to them and say, "Do you need anything, Venerable One?" So they're just parasites living on the back of society, on the back of you. You people are working, going out, hard work, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And these guys are just sitting in their rooms, you know, they just think they're being holy. Then they get up all sanctimonious and say, "You should do good deeds, you should make offerings to the Sangha." So don't believe them. Okay, so those are considered aspects of wrong view. And let's just finish up, then we'll have lunch, and then we can have questions and discussion after the lunch break. Okay, so then we have, how does the true or the good person give gifts as a good person? So the good person gives a gift carefully, or sakkacchan. Also, this could be rendered respectfully. He gives it with his own hand. So this is, you know, it's considered like the mark of, like, the aristocrat will tell the servant, "You give the gift." But for a good person should be willing to give the gift with his own hand, because that shows some humility. So he gives it showing respect. Actually, this is somewhat similar to the first one. He gives a valuable gift. So not, you know, keeping the valuable items for himself and then just giving, you know, if he has a something which is sort of worn out, beaten up, and he was thinking, you know, maybe tomorrow I'm going to throw this, when the garbage collection comes, I'm going to throw this out. And then somebody comes and says, "Do you have an extra toothbrush?" Or so he thinks, "Ah, I don't have to throw this out, but I just give this to him." And he gives with the view that something will come of it. Maybe some people will find this a little disturbing. Isn't this sort of like a little bit like you're thinking, well, when I give something, am I, is it going to be a good investment? You know, am I going to get good returns on it? Like if I invest in the stock market, am I going to get some good dividends on that investment? So when I make a gift, am I going to get some good returns on it, some good karma that's going to come? So
I was
going to
say good karma.
Yeah. David?
He's asking if something good will come of it. Is
yeah.
He asking if something good will come of it for me or for the other person?
I think the way it's intended, if I understand it, with the view that something will come of it. Yeah, I didn't see, look at the Pali for this. But I think the idea is that there is going to be some benefit coming back to oneself. And I'll just explain the way I understand this. That there's a difference between giving with the view that something will come of it, which means up recognizing that the law of cause and effect is working objectively, and giving with the desire to get something in return. And I would say that giving with the desire to get something in return is giving with some degree of greed associated with the act of giving. So in that case, one is seeking one's own benefit. Giving with the view that something will come of it is giving with the recognition that the gift will does create the wholesome karma, which will come back in some way beneficial to myself, but at the same time that one is giving, one should be detaching oneself from the desire for that benefit. Though there is also a certain degree, I would say, in which when we give or do other wholesome actions, I'd say it's justifiable in wishing to have good results come from it. Not in the sense that I give because I want to become a multimillionaire, or I praise others because I want, as a karmic result, to be praised in return, or I observe precepts because by doing so I'm going to be free from illness and have a long lifespan. Well, maybe that's a justifiable reason. Okay, but I'd say as a person who's a human being now, I want to come back into the human realm, or maybe some people want to have a rebirth in the heavenly realm, in order to have the opportunity to continue to practice the Dharma. I want to generate enough merit so that I'll come into contact with the Dharma early in my life, and have good conditions for practicing, so that I'll be free from illness. Like right now, like I have a chronic head pain condition, which is a big obstacle to my practice. And so maybe this is the result of some bad karma, and I don't want to get it to, you know, if I went to here, learn that as a result of some karmic deed that I did in the past, I'm going to have to endure this headache for 7 lives in the future. I'll throw up my hands and think, oh, what misery. Is there something I can do, some kind of really powerful, wholesome karma that will counteract that, so that at least in my next life I won't have this head pain? And so there seems justifiable reasons for wishing to have good results from good deeds. So it's not all just, you know, calculating from a rather egoistic and narrow, selfish point of view. And also, when we have good conditions for ourselves, then we can benefit others more effectively. So I might, you know, in giving, might want to become wealthy myself, not so that I can have a mansion and 5 cars, but if I'm wealthy, well off, then I can do more deeds that will be of true benefit to others. Okay, so let us wrap up the discussion for this morning, and we can adjourn for the lunch. And then we could come back at, say, 12:15, and then we can discuss questions, problems, thoughts that arise from this sutta. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the Dhamma-protecting deities, the Bhutas, the fear spirits, the Nagas, the dragon spirits, and all other beings in the world. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumodita Chiram Rakantu Sasana Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodita Chiram Rakantu Desana Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodita Chiram Rakantu Mamparam Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabbe sadhanamo dantu sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamochantu pusanto nibbutin. Just two short announcements. Yeah, next weekend I might be away, so we won't be having a class next weekend. That's the 8th of May, this is the 16th. We have the next class on the 23rd, and even though there's the meditation retreat, but the registration starts in the afternoon, so we can have the class in the morning. I'm not sure whether we have it here, or if they arrange this room for the meditation retreat in the morning. Then we can meet in the library for the class. That will come with the announcement, when the announcement is sent out. Then tomorrow afternoon, we have David Loy, who's right here, right now. He will be giving the public lecture in the library series on the theme of Buddhism and the West. How is it? Why Buddhism and the West need one another. David is one of, I would say, our foremost American writers on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, modern Western civilization. And I'm sure his talk will have very stimulating and deep insights into this issue. So I encourage you to come to the talk. It will be at 2 p.m. in the Wuru Library. And I noticed that on the website there's registration for the talk, and so if you want to be sure of having a seat, because already we're expecting 50 people to come for the talk, you might go to the office in the Big Buddha Hall to register for the lecture. Did I cover everything? Okay, so we'll end with 3 half-bows to the Buddha.
Thank you.